Good morning. It is 9:02, Wednesday, May 13th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and it's somehow 45 degrees outside my window right now.
This is Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and in the real world, happy almost Preakness Day.
Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And I'm so glad we have other news items to talk about. Otherwise, we would have been stuck with my favorite horse name, which is actually a horse named Zamboni.
Brian DiDonato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine. I've got nothing particularly witty to say at the start of this thing, so let's get into it.
You don't even like hockey. Why would you like Zamboni?
Zamboni because the play on words, the sire was Ice Capade and the dam was Sweeping Beauty. And I just always thought that was such an awesome, the horse ran like twice, was a second rate stallion, but for some reason, you know, it resonated with me 30 years after the horse's career was over. Zamboni. The other one was we named a horse named One Ball, Two Strikes because he was a Ridgeline.
I feel like I remember that horse too.
Yep. He almost made $10,000 also, but it was a cute name at least. So.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select is a great way to support the hardworking Backstretch community right now. Proceeds from all wagers placed through Keeneland Select this month will benefit Nourish the Backstretch, providing weekly meals and groceries to stable area workers at Keeneland and the Thoroughbred Center. You can sign up at www.keenelandselect.com. There was a little bit of stakes action last weekend on Saturday in the Sunshine Forever Stakes at Gulfstream Halliday, who's like an upcoming turf miler for Todd Pletcher. He's a Keeneland grad, Keeneland September Book One graduate, probably on his way to a grade one date at some point. Keeneland September yearling sale scheduled to begin Monday, September 14th. Keeneland's optimistic that people will be able to attend. Inspect yearlings are participating in the live auction, and they're taking tremendous steps to ensure the safety. But they're also building additional bidding options, both phone and online. And that's where I'll bring in John Green, who sat in on some online mock bidding. What did you learn, John?
Yeah, Joe, it was really incredible. You know, we had a chance to not only do a tutorial for about an hour, and then they gave us each $1 million of mythical dollars to bid on, you know, 20 or 30 horses. And it was just amazing. The platform they had, you can click on the horse, you could see the pedigree, you could see past performances. You could even see the vetting information on the horse, as well as a video of the horse walking and standing confirmation wise. Probably even more impressively was you could actually bid on the horse and it was live. So as I was bidding, there were other people from around the world who were also competing against me for those horses. And literally you would hit a bid and within 3 seconds, you would have an email and a text verifying your bid and telling you whether or not you were the high bid or not. So I was floored with just how amazing the platform is. And it makes me feel better knowing that if I can't travel to Kentucky for the September sale, I can sit right here in my office and almost have instant access.
For sure. And so I think Keeneland's doing their best to make sure everyone's covered, no matter how the September yearling sale looks this year. So this week, thank the Lord, we have major racing to look forward to. We did have some with Oakland, and we're going to talk to Louis Sella later about the recently completed meet, but it doesn't really feel like spring unless Kentucky, California, and New York are all running. We've got two out of the three now. Churchill Downs drew the opening day Saturday card. Yesterday, they had 162 entries for 11 races. Pretty much everything is oversubscribed. The only race I saw that wasn't oversubscribed is the fourth race, which features the return of everybody's favorite champion, Monomoy Girl, Mr. Entire four-year-old season, and will be back making her five-year-old debut. Looking forward to that. But I just think in general, we have a lot to be thankful for in racing because, you know, this is not the case with other sports. You know, I think most other sports are at least months away from starting, if not more, and are really wondering whether or not it's even worth playing or completing the season in 2020. You know, baseball had a little bit of a proposal this week from the owners about starting an abbreviated season in July, possibly some neutral site cities where the outbreak isn't as bad. But the players are going to have to sign off on that, and it doesn't seem like they're too enthusiastic about it. Racing is in a unique position, and we talked about this, you know, in the weeks preceding. But it's really a blessing to see top horses on the racetrack again. It's great for us. It's even better for the horsemen who are now able to make a living, especially the smaller horsemen. I talked to Greg Foley yesterday for a story in last night's TDN. I think it's really, you know, it's particularly special for Louisville natives to be back in Churchill because it's been so upset by the lack of the Derby this spring. So I'm really happy for all those guys. But I think, you know, racing has, you know, as it's had in the past couple of months, it has a unique opportunity to take center stage here. Just before I get to you guys, I remember I was looking at the ESPN website a week ago, and for the first time I can ever remember, two of the top headlines were horse racing stories. One of them was Baffert, and the other one was the virtual Derby. So, I mean, this is a unique time where we're not only the only game in town betting wise, but in terms of entertainment. And I'm very, very happy. It's been a tough couple months, but it's going to be a lot tougher for other sports fans. So what are you guys looking forward to this weekend?
Well, I think what we're looking forward to mostly is return of racing to Churchill Downs. And like you said, that Saturday card, Joe, is just through the roof fantastic. I mean, you have one of the most interesting horses in all of racing in Monomoy Girl coming back on Saturday. And, you know, we're still a million miles away from normal. And by normal, I mean every racetrack running in the country that should be running with fans in the stands. But at least we're definitely headed in the right direction. But there's one thing I wanted to bring up, and maybe I shouldn't because the story changes by the hour, and we're doing this at 9 a.m, and maybe this afternoon at 5 o'clock would be different. But what the heck is going on at Santa Anita? And they are going ahead full steam, taking entries, put out a stake schedule. But as of 9:08 or whatever it is on Wednesday morning, they have not officially been given any approval by the LA County Board of Health to resume running. And then yesterday, the LA County Board of Health put out the most draconian thing you could possibly imagine, saying the shutdown is going to continue for another 3 months. So this is fascinating, the story. And Santa Anita is not talking. They're not saying what's going on. But might they just run on Friday and just say, the heck with it, we're going to go ahead and run and see what happens?
That's an excellent point. And we always focus on the big three as far as New York, Churchill, and Santa Anita, or California, New York, and Kentucky. And certainly, you know, there's news on all those. We're still waiting to hear on New York as to whether or not they're going to be opening Memorial Day weekend or a couple weeks later. And I know they're working feverishly with the government in order to basically designate the racing facility as its own standalone entity. So that's an interesting tactic that they're trying to take. But there was also a couple of other announcements of some other racetracks that we don't talk about a lot. One being Indiana Grand, that's going to be opening on June 15th. And they actually changed their schedule around. So they're actually going to be racing Monday through Thursday, which I thought was a very interesting niche to look out for, because most of the major racetracks are looking for the weekend, looking for the, you know, for the big splashy stake races to promote over the weekend for, you know, for handicappers. And they went the opposite way, Indiana Grand. They said there's an opening on, especially early in the week, on Mondays and Tuesdays, where there aren't any other major racing venues open. So let's change and go Monday through Thursday. So kudos to them for zigging when everyone else was zagging.
Yeah, that was definitely smart. I think they do typically run early to midweek, but usually they also run on Saturday. So it makes sense to kind of, you know, move the schedule a little bit and be a more of a focus. To Bill's point, I do think the LA County kind of walked back what they said about the 3 month thing. I think it's maybe not as, you know, maybe measures aren't going to be as significant as it sounded at when in that meeting. Like we also said, Churchill's entries, that Saturday card is super, super impressive. And I mean, those races are tough. Our horses ship tomorrow, and I haven't seen a two-year-old. Ours are all two-year-olds, and I'm a little afraid to see what the two-year-old races look like, because it's just going to be a salty meet like it was at the end of Oaklawn with all these guys shipping in. So, you know, we're happy to run. It's definitely going to be competitive. We wouldn't mind a few more tracks opening up. So, you know, maybe it's a little lighter, but it's good to see racing back in Kentucky.
We should also mention that Woodbine yesterday said they're looking at June 6th or June 13th to reopen and are going to run the Queen's Plate in September. Then, you know, like you said, Indiana Grand, which is, I'm always surprised that more tracks don't do that. The more tracks don't run on Mondays and Tuesdays just because there's so little competition. And Indiana Grand is not bad racing. They got a nice little turf course. They got a decent stake schedule, so I'm always surprised that more tracks don't do that. About Santa Anita, they're acting as if they're going to get the okay. They, like Bill said, they're going full speed ahead. They have the entries, they have the past performances out. I mean, it would be insane to me for them to be acting like this without some kind of handshake agreement or understanding that they're going to be able to run. Or maybe, like Bill said, they're just saying, I dare you to close us down. But either way, I would expect Santa Anita to be back at least for this weekend, and then we'll see what happens after that. I kind of wanted to transition from that into the three-year-old schedule because, you know, we talked to Jack Knowlton a while ago. We talked to Bob Baffert last week, and just how unorthodox it is to have the three-year-old calendar be so barren. Well, that's not totally the case anymore with Churchill coming back and assuming Santa Anita is going to be able to come back. And the three-year-old calendar is starting to piece together a little bit, starting next Saturday with the Grade 3 Matt Wynn Stakes at Churchill. This is a stake they used to run on the Stephen Foster undercard. Like I said, I talked to Greg Foley yesterday. He's got a horse pointing towards there in major fed, probably going to be a huge oversubscribed field. But so you got that now. You got the Santa Anita Derby. After that, you have the Los Alamitos Derby. You've got the Haskell not too long after that. Who knows what's going to happen with New York, but I think it's good for the trainers of these horses to at least have some kind of map now towards the Derby in September, because it seemed a month ago when we were talking to Jack Knowlton that these horses might have to go on the shelf. And it really wasn't that long ago that we were worried, not so much about the top three-year-olds, but we were worried about horses in general being lost in the shuffle. Because we didn't know how long this interruption was going to last. And, you know, it's been tough for the last 2 months. It's been pretty scarce, but like I said, at least racing is in a position to be able to come back. And now there are North Stars on the calendar to be able to point to. John, I know you got a good three-year-old, turf three-year-old and proven strategies. Have you guys looked at the calendar down the line at all in terms of what's next for him?
Yeah, well, for, you know, Proven Strategies, he's basically been running in overnight handicaps, you know, last time, and then an allowance race before that. But because of the dearth of racing options, those races have come up, you know, very tough, like Brian alluded to before. I mean, the end of the Oaklawn meet, the end of the Gulfstream meet was killer racing. And just to place in some of those races, you know, you would think you were running in graded stake races. So Proven Strategies, we're still waiting to see what opens up for the upcoming races. We had anticipated that we were going to try to run him in a couple of the million-dollar races at Saratoga and Belmont. But for right now, those are on hold. So we're kind of in a holding pattern still. If he was a dirt horse, I could tell you that as of yesterday, with all of these other preps that are being back on the calendar, there would be a whole host of different options for us. But for the turf racing, Joe, it's a good question. There still aren't a lot of options for us at this point.
Right. And then just going back to the point about how salty the meat is going to be at Churchill. I was talking about the two-year-old races not that long ago. Wesley Ward really hasn't done well with his two-year-olds at Gulfstream. And that suggests to me that, not that Wesley Ward forgot how to train two-year-olds, that he saved all those good ones for the Churchill meet. And maybe New York in a month or so. So wish you luck, Brian. It's going to probably going to be the A team that's coming to Churchill.
Not too worried. We've got one. We've got the right one for him.
There you go. Very nice.
Give it out.
I think I got to protect my price. I don't want to be right if we're wrong. We'll see. The first one we enter is pretty good.
Okay.
Here we go.
We'll have to go with that. But you just getting back to the three-year-olds, I want to toss it to Bill on this because he had the story about whether or not the Preakness is going to be run. There was a rumor last week that October 3rd is now the date they're looking forward to. Stronic Group shot that down, but I wonder if it is going to be a month after the Derby, where the Belmont would fit in, and just whether or not this should be looked at as a legitimate Triple Crown with this facing so awkward.
Well, all good questions, Joe. And first of all, let's go back to what happened since our last podcast. There was a report from a Baltimore TV station that the Preakness was going to be run on October 3rd. And what's significant about it is it was the NBC affiliate. So you would think that they would have some sort of inside information. As soon as that came out, the Stronach Group didn't say it's not going to happen, They just said, you know, hold on, nothing is set in stone. I tend to believe that that report is accurate because, again, the connection from WBAL in Baltimore to NBC. And remember the whole connection with Notre Dame football. If any of the Triple Crown races are looking for dates, they're going to have to go to NBC and say, can we have it on this day? And if NBC says, no, you can't because we have Notre Dame versus Stanford or something at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're not going to be able to have a broadcast of the Triple Crown race. So again, just for the sake of argument, let's say that the Preakness is going to be run on October 3rd, then there's no chance the Belmont is going to be run after the Preakness in that window between October 3rd and the Breeders' Cup. It just, you can't do it. Nobody would run in the race. Everybody would pass and look to the Breeders' Cup, of course, unless perhaps, you know, a horse is going for the Triple Crown. So what's going to happen to the Belmont? I do think there's a possibility now that it'll be run before the Kentucky Derby. The question of does that make it a legitimate Triple Crown? I'll pass on that. I really don't have a strong feeling. See if John Bryan or even yourself feels that way. It'll be certainly a different Triple Crown, but it's the only kind of Triple Crown we can have with the circumstances that are plaguing racing and all of society right now.
I'll jump in, you know, because you opened it up, Bill. I appreciate that. To me, as a purist, I really don't feel like that it would be a true Triple Crown, especially if it's out of order. If it's, you know, the Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont still, you know, 2 weeks and 3 weeks away from, you know, from each other, then yes, to me, that would still be a genuine Triple Crown. But if it's going to be changing of distances, which it may have to be for the Belmont, and changing of duration between races, then it's not the true test that it's been over the years in my view.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not the Triple Crown that we're used to. I mean, the reality is this year is just so strange that I feel like it's, you know, it kind of is what it is. It's not the end of the world. Christina Bostanakis had an interesting story last week kind of about the history of the Triple Crown races. And I'm pretty sure some of those, you know, early Triple Crown winners who were credited with winning the Triple Crown were winning it at different distances and with different schedules. So it's not like the race has been the same for its entire, or the series of races has been the same for its entire history.
I think that, you know, going back to the Preakness rumored date, I think that really puts Belmont in a box and really forces them to try to have to run it earlier in the year, which is tough because it's going to run up against Saratoga and the Travers, because it just seems like if they try to squeeze it in between the October 3rd Preakness date, if that comes to fruition, and the Breeders' Cup, nobody is going to run in that thing unless you happen to have a horse who won the first two legs. Who in their right mind would go to the Belmont instead of the Breeders' Cup? You know, it just seems like the Pimlico and the Preakness are kind of putting Belmont in a bind in that way. I guess you're right that the Triple Crown hasn't always been run the same way, but I don't know. I just kind of think there should be an asterisk no matter what happens this year. The Derby, maybe we can keep it the same way, but it just, I wouldn't consider it a legitimate Triple Crown victory if someone were to win this year, especially if the Belmont is squeezed into this tiny window where it's going up against the Breeders' Cup. I think it's wait till next year in terms of getting excited about the Triple Crown. I think this year, I know the Derby's still going to be the Derby, whether or not there are fans in the building. But other than that, I don't think it's going to be the same feeling and the same kind of historic result that we usually look for when it comes to the Triple Crown.
I will say that, I mean, we're talking about the Belmont itself and these races, but these cards are also just great race cards. I mean, the Belmont card as a whole is maybe the card of the year. A lot of times I think, you know, a summer card with all those races, the Met Mile and all those other races would be great and really exciting. And I mean, yeah, it's not the Triple Crown, but it would still be a great, you know, really, really exciting race card. And, you know, it would make more sense to run it in the summer and kind of keep it away from those later season races.
Well, that segues into something I wanted to talk about, which is news from one of the sponsors this week, that Keeneland is considering running a summer meet. T.D. Thornton talked to Bob Elliston in his weekend review this week in the TDN about the possibility of Keeneland running during the summer. Now, it's very tricky because, first of all, in the local area, they don't want to step on the toes of Ellis Park, because Ellis Park only has that one meet. And I think Kentucky tracks are generally pretty respectful of that they only have those 2 months really to have the Kentucky calendar to themselves. while a lot of Kentucky horsemen are shipping up to Saratoga. But who knows what Saratoga is going to look like this year. I think the other thing is, you know, we're at this point right now where there are so few big races that every single big race is drawing a million horses and grade one caliber. I wonder if during the summer, if there's Saratoga, Del Mar, and Keeneland going on at the same time, if we might have the opposite problem when racing starts to overcorrect and then there are grade one races, you know, all the time. And they said, to their credit, Bob Ellison said that they're going to try to work with other tracks. We always applaud cooperation here. That's very far too rare in racing. So they said they're going to try to work with other tracks so they're not stepping on the toes of these other grade one races. But the summer racing is just, it's so jam packed with Saratoga and Del Mar that it just, it seems like it's going to be difficult not to, you know, overlap with some of those other big races. What do you guys think? Do you think this is feasible? Obviously, we all love Keeneland racing. We would love to see racing back at Keeneland. We missed the spring meet. But what do you think about the feasibility of squeezing that meet in during the summer?
Joe, I do think it's feasible, but only if they make it a very short meet. If they're talking about taking the spring meet and plopping it into August, that's not going to work. And from reading TD's story with Ellison, it seems like they are thinking along those lines. So yeah, it might be trying to stuff a lot of racing into a small period, the opposite of what we're going through now. But imagine if they just run like 3 days, almost like a mini Breeders' Cup type meet, and put some of their big stakes races, their grade ones, on the calendar from the spring stakes schedule. That seems what they're thinking of. And I think they'll be able to work it out. I mean, there is a spirit of cooperation that we really haven't seen in racing. But, you know, this is causing people to work together for the good of the game, which is something we've all been preaching for since we've started these podcasts. Exactly. So I think it's doable. I really do. And it would be kind of exciting to see, you know, three superstar days of racing at Keeneland with, you know, every card have three or four stakes races on it. So I think they can make it work. And I hope Keeneland can pull it off.
Yeah, Bill, you're exactly right. They have to have some of these major stake races on the calendar because they build pedigrees. I mean, the Ashland and the Beaumont and the Shackleford and I mean, there's a whole host of graded stake races that usually run in the April meet and the spring meet that have just been obliterated off the map basically for right now. So if they were to have some kind of a shortened meet affair type thing, you know, not only would it be good for the racing business, it would bleed over into the breeding industry, which obviously Keeneland is very conscious of. And then they would also be able to use it kind of as a test run, as a beta test for the way that they're going to run the Breeders' Cup. Because don't forget, the Breeders' Cup is right there a couple of weeks later, probably.
Right. Yeah. And I think it definitely makes sense. I think they could probably squeeze it in. Maybe before, let's assume Saratoga and Del Mar run on their normal schedule. There's time in, you know, early July or something that it might make sense. So I think, I mean, we're all for it.
I think, yeah, that's the idea. It should be like a small boutique meet. I think similar to what Kentucky Downs does, where they squeeze a lot of really good racing into only 5 days. I think you guys are right that the loss of a lot of those big stakes in the spring at Keeneland was felt across the industry. And I agree that if they can manage to do it in a short amount of time, I think, yeah, we should be all for it. It's top quality racing. And like I said, we miss watching racing at Keeneland. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how it works out. And I think we're going to, you know, thankfully in due course, go from not enough racing to maybe too much racing and it really no overflowing calendar, but we'll take it after what we've been through the last couple of months. Brian, did you like that shout out to Heather in due course? That's one of the Heatherisms.
That is one of them. I think that's an old, the European guys that work, you know, I think they, you know, some of the people who work on the European stuff picked it up from the cafe racing guys overseas. Yeah, it's a long, there are a lot of TDNisms that we have that no one else would understand.
I should throw it a commercial by saying we'll be back in two shakes of a lamb's tail. Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Hard Not to Love is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit their website, westpointtb.com. So this week's news, big news in terms of the breeding game and the stallion game. the Jockey Club, which had floated this idea last year about capping the number of mares a stallion can be bred to in 1 year to 140. Got elicited a lot of response, both for and against at the time. This week, they made it official. This past week, they made it official that that's going to be their policy going forward, starting with horses born in 2020. So everybody from 2019 and backward will be able to still operate the way that they've been doing. They'll be grandfathered in. 2020 and beyond, horses will be capped at 140 mares. This is above my pay grade. I'm obviously not, I don't have stallion interests or anything like that, but there's nothing above John Grain's pay grade. So he wrote a good op-ed in today's TDN, asking some good questions about the science of it and not necessarily disagreeing with the Jockey Club, but wanting more information. John, I'll toss it to you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Joe. Basically, the reason why I was moved to write an op-ed piece on this rule change was really twofold. One, I wanted to know, you know, what the rationale was from a scientific standpoint as to why 140 mare cap was the right number, or if there even needs to be a cap at all. And the second reason, the second question I had was what other options were discussed? Because again, being in New Jersey, not being a Kentucky farm owner or a stallion owner, there's a lot of meetings and decisions that are, you know, way outside of my purview. And not that John Grain needs to be, you know, fly in the wall or in the room with all these decisions. But when you have a major decision like this, a rule change, it's going to impact not one but two industries. I mean, the breeding and really the racing industry also. You would think that it would be more open for public discussion rather than setting up a trial balloon in September saying, this is what we're thinking, and then ultimately having some back channel, you know, meetings and making a decision and then coming out and just putting the decision out there and saying, this is what we're doing. In this day and age of transparency, that is the exact opposite way of a rule change, you know, in an industry. And I can go into the whole economics of you know, of pros and cons of why I think it could or couldn't work. But what it really comes down to for me is transparency. Why is the rule change being, you know, being implemented now? Why is the cap at 140 mares bred? And really, what other options were discussed? And that's what, you know, had me go ahead and write out the op-ed piece, you know, for discussion. And I think that some of the initial feedback I've gotten on both sides has been, you know, very true to course. I mean, there's some great points on both sides of the ledger, but the important point is that we're discussing it and now we're discussing it after the fact. So I don't know really what kind of impact this is going to have on this rule, but I would love it if it would start some discussion on any future rulings that are going to be implemented by the Jockey Club going forward. I'll get off my soapbox in a minute. We can kind of open it up for discussion. But one of the things that I respect about the Jockey Club is that in this current day and age, they are being very proactive about making changes. They've implemented some safety changes. They've implemented some of the drug testing changes. And I think that's great because they're identifying that there is an imbalance in the racing industry that they can help change. And basically what they're trying to do is curtail cheating in that situation. So they're trying to make sure that people who cheat and don't play by the rules, that if they're caught, they get reprimanded and heavily so. This isn't a situation of a farm cheat or farms cheating the system. This is a situation of them competing under the rules and basically beating other farms at the game. Basically, picking better stallions, pricing them better, or giving better incentivization for people to breed to them, which is why there's a lot more than the 140 mares, or why those stallions are being bred on a lot more occasion than other stallions. So I really just wanted to get to the root of why they thought a change was needed, what went into the science behind, you know, the change, and ultimately what other decisions were being, you know, were being bandied about, or discussions were being bandied about. So at least we as a general industry have a better understanding of what thought process they're going through. And ultimately they have the right to regulate this. I'm not saying they don't, but I would just like to have a little bit more open discussion about it. So that way it looks like that they're trying to fix the problem at hand, which is really the safety of horses, the health of horses, and ultimately, increasing the gene pool.
I sold it before we started talking about this, like John, like I was going to attack John, but I totally agree with the point that, I mean, you know, more transparency about the statistics or whatever would be great. I mean, more of an open discussion would be great. I think one thing that people need to take into consideration is this is a forward thinking rule. And you might say, oh, this isn't really an issue right now, but the full crop is going to continue to shrink. We're going to, you know, it's going to become more of an issue in 10 years, in 20 years. And I definitely applaud the Jockey Club for at least thinking into the future, because it doesn't seem in racing like we do that very often. So I think from that perspective, it's, you know, definitely a good move. I don't know the exact, you know, the 140 thing. I don't know. I mean, if you look at the report of Mare's Bread, it seems like a good stopping point, I guess. I mean, there are some stallions who bred to a lot more mares than that. There were two who bred to 252 mares in 2019. So obviously there are going to be some who are taking a significant hit in that way. But I mean, in terms of supply and demand, I would think it kind of corrects itself. And, you know, the 252nd best mare bred to some of these stallions is a lot different than the best mare bred to these stallions. And you kind of see it all the time. So I think stud fees will adjust. A lot of things will adjust.
I wanted to ask John another question on this whole subject. John, and I know, as you said, you know, you're not a farm owner, you're not a stallion owner, but do you think there'll be a lawsuit on this, you know, from the people who are going to be hurt financially from this? And, you know, what are their next steps? I know it's just asking you to speculate and predict, but will they just throw up their hands and say, okay, we just have to deal with the rules as they are now? Or could this drag on in the courts?
Yeah. And, you know, Bill, you hit exactly on the legal aspect, the legal question that they have. My understanding is that the Jockey Club has the full right and regulatory authorization to implement a rule like this, and it's not considered a restraint of trade. Okay. Now, again, that's for legal minds to discuss, but the feedback I'm getting from lawyers is that it would be a tough thing to try to prove. I think what's going to happen, though, is that instead of going through the legal avenues, that some of these stallions are going to relocate, because the Jockey Club only has purview and jurisdiction over North America. So what's to stop a Coolmore, for example, from buying the breeding rights to the next great horse and then saying, we're just going to shuttle that horse between Europe and South America and breed the horse to as many horses as we want them to. And then if people want to import those homebreds back into the United States, which seems to be, you know, the current theme is that we're bringing more horses back from Europe, then that's kind of be their kind of workaround as far as, you know, avoiding kind of a lawsuit or upsetting the apple cart, you know, being the Jockey Club. So, but I think you're right. There's going to be a lot of talk about and kind of legal maneuvering and discussion about this. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to be the path of least resistance. And these guys are going to find alternative opportunities to move their stallions to other places where they can breed unlimited number of mares. And that's really why I was recommending some of the things that I put in the op-ed piece, which is instead of, you know, putting the stick, the detriment, saying you can't do this, why not try to encourage outside influences of, you know, different gene pools to come into the United States, or offer incentivization, you know, for out what I'm calling outcrosses, elevating their status and giving them other opportunities, because then you're avoiding lawsuits altogether.
But I want to go back to something that Brian touched upon, and I agree with him. Is this really such a financial hardship on the stallion farms and owners that we're breeding the 252 mares? Let's say stallion X's stud fee is $50,000. He's breeding to 250 mares. Now he can only breed to 140. Obviously, the stud fee is going to go up. I mean, that's just the very basics of supply and demand. And also, as Brian said, I mean, overall, the quality of their mares, of the whole, is going to be so much better, because mares 1 through 140 are certainly better than mares 141 through 250. So, you know, will they not make as much money as they used to? Yeah, probably. But I think you have to look at a bigger picture and say this isn't, from a financial standpoint, a bloodbath for these guys.
You can make that argument, Bill. And the counter argument to that, I would say, is it's not just even a matter of the dollars and cents per year. What's going to happen is horses that were popular, that were being bred to 250 mares, may have produced, I'm guesstimating, 200 foals. Okay. So the foal crop is going to be a third larger than you know, another horse's foal crop that isn't being bred to as many horses. So when we talk about, gee, there's a couple of daredevil fillies that are really doing well in his first crop, everyone's talking about the two daredevils that are running in graded stake races. Nobody's talking about the other 130 that may or may not have broken their maiden. Okay. It's just, you know, it's a star driven industry. So if my foal crop is going to be a third greater than your foal crop, and I get one more graded stake winner out of that group that is on the Derby campaign or on the Oaks, people are going to be talking about my stallion more than your stallion. And it's not necessarily because I made more money in stud fees that year. It's because I have more foals on the ground, and therefore I have a bigger chance, a bigger pool of hitting a graded stake winner out of that crop. So I think it has more to do with the overall outlook of a horse than it does the overall, year-to-year financials.
Well, I think another thing we're kind of completely glossing over here is it only applies to horses born in 2020 or later. So, I mean, the economics of it are going to change. Stud farms are going to be able to adapt. It's not hurting these horses who are currently covering these many mares. I think the one thing that's trickiest, and John Sakura mentioned this in our coverage, is that it kind of creates this weird dichotomy with like the grandfathered in stallions and the new stallions, which is maybe the trickiest aspect of this whole thing. But I mean, it's never going to be perfect. And I think it still is probably better than nothing. But yeah, I mean, that's the one tricky thing, that you're going to have stallions who are restricted at the same competing against stallions who aren't.
Yeah. I mean, that has potential to make it harder for new stallions to find a foothold. I think when they're competing against the Into Mischiefs of the world, and Into Mister probably, I think he's one of the reasons that this whole thing came to be, is that I think a lot of people are mad that Into Mischief is such a good stallion and can cover 250 mares in a year, that he takes up a lot of market share. But yeah, it's like he's probably got another good 10, 15 years left. He's still pretty young. So it's going to make it a little tricky for newer stallions to compete with that. The other thing they were talking about, the other reasoning that the Jockey Club had behind this decision was inbreeding, and John alluded to that before. I'm not an expert in terms of pedigrees and outcrosses and all that, but John, you made some interesting points about whether or not this will actually make a dent in that.
Yeah, and again, I'm not a geneticist, and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I can't even pretend to be one. I did get a great report because of the op-ed piece, I got a great report sent to me from Performance Genetics. And it was a report that's online from 2011. And it talked about, it was like 42 pages long. So I got up this morning at 5 a.m. and I actually kind of read through it until my eyes glossed over, because it was just so much information. Then I went to the conclusion. Okay. And the conclusion basically said that, there were two findings, and this is my very boiled down version of the great report. Number one was that there was an influx of inbreeding in the horse industry, and it increased exponentially from 1996 until 2011. That was the period of time that they looked at it. And that they made a leap and said, because of the inbreeding and because of the projected continued inbreeding, that it would affect the soundness of racehorses down the road. Now, the first part is science. The second part is making an analysis based on that science. But I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that the Jockey Club is necessarily looking at that part of it as being the driver of this rule. I really think it has more to do with the economics and the inability to compete against some of these farms than it does the actual soundness of the horses. Because if it had to do with the soundness of the horses based on that, you know, inbreeding analysis, then you would want to encourage outcrosses. So you would want to encourage outside gene pools to come into the state. So I may be a little bit of a cynic, but again, I don't have a stallion, I don't have a farm, so it's not affecting me. I'm trying to look at this as openly and straightforward as possible. I just really believe that if it had to do with soundness and with the gene pool, you know, correction, which I'm all 100% in favor on, then those should have been the rules that would have been implemented, versus we're going to make it a more even playing field and cap the number of mares that can be bred to a stallion going forward. And I'm glad that they grandfathered the existing ones, because that makes it a little easier to figure out as a breeder. But at the end of the day, I'm a cynic. I'm not convinced that that was the primary driver behind this rule change.
I think it comes down to what's simplest, though. I mean, John, you suggested other options, and to me, those were way more complicated and, you know, more invasive, I would say, you know, propping up certain stallions or, you know, some of the ideas you had or certain restricted races for black type. I think that's way more invasive than just leveling the playing field and saying, okay, everyone, you know, everyone starts with 140. Let's see who has the best stallion. To me, that's, I know it's restrictive, but in some sense, I think it's actually more fair and, you know, less restrictive at the same time.
But the good thing is that we're having this conversation, Brian, because
I agree with that for sure.
You know, that's the important thing about all this is that there are other opportunities other than restrictive, you know, restraint of trade in essence, which is what's going on, you know, with this rule change. Certainly those ideas, my ideas aren't the be all and end all. I mean, I literally thought of them, you know, yesterday morning when I was writing the op-ed, and those were the ones that came to light. The reason why it came to light was, years ago, the Meadowlands, and Bill, you'll appreciate this because I think you wrote a piece on it years and years ago. There was a race at the Meadowlands we used to run at night during the fall called the Galloping Ghost. And it was a Galloping Ghost Stake. And basically, it was the race that they ran on Halloween or on Mischief Night. And it was restricted for grays and roans that, you know, that basically had a heartbeat. Okay. I mean, that was the only restriction. And I remember entering a horse that we own named Going Gray, ironically enough, in the race. And one of the horses that came in the paddock was like this jet black horse and was 1-5 and of course won the race. And I remember going back and saying, how could that horse have gotten in the race when the only restriction was that it had to be gray or roan? And if you look at the Jockey Club papers, the horse was gray. Okay. And there's different shades of gray, obviously. You know, they even made a movie about it, 50 Shades of Gray. Okay. Different shades.
A little different, slightly different.
That was coming, right? And it's because based on the Jockey Club definition, that horse was considered a gray horse and over time had gotten darker, you know, based on its, you know, on its lineage, I guess, but it was still considered a gray horse. So the Jockey Club does have the ability to define certain ideas, make definitions on certain things that are, you know, part of the horse's core. And that is the standing definition that we all have to abide by. So if they can do it for that, they could very easily, it's very simple right now to go on any website, any farm's website and say, based on your stallion and based on my mare, give me a 5-cross or a 7-cross pedigree of what it's going to look like. And it'll give you all of the inbreeding. I mean, you don't have to pay for it. It's that simple. And basically, when you register your foal, if you were online and you had to put in, here's a copy of, or here's the inbreeding for the first 5 generations, you're doing the work for the Jockey Club. All they have to do is basically add that one line onto the certificate, which is now online. And it would be there with the horse's name, with the horse's ID number, with the color, and all the other things that are defined by the Jockey Club. And it wouldn't be any extra work for them. And then when you're entering the horse, it's very simple to know if he's eligible for that race or not. That's kind of what the thought process behind all of that was, that it wouldn't be extra work, it wouldn't be restraint of trade, and it would open up opportunities for some of these other horses to maybe get black type or even just earn more money, but then get brought back into the breeding pool, the gene pool, which is, I thought the whole point of this exercise was to increase the gene pool. That's kind of where I came up with that idea. But it's not the only idea for sure, but it's one
that... It's interesting that last year Saratoga started doing those restricted races for horses who were bought for $45,000 or less at an auction. And generally you're not going to see too many Into Mischiefs or Tappets in those races. So I think that was an interesting kind of first step to level the playing field and give some smaller sires a chance to shine on the big stage.
Sure. Absolutely.
I think that had more to do with the owners, but I mean, the economics, I don't want to really get on my high horse. John was talking about getting on his. The economics of racing for almost everybody is broken. It's not good. If you're an owner, you're dead in the water. I mean, what percentage of horses make money? 10%?
Yep.
And things aren't getting any better, and the foal crop's going to continue to shrink. And I think this at least addresses some issues. And I think long-term, for a sport that's not looking great right now statistically, I think it helps some things. And I think, I mean, I hope, I'd like to see more forward-thinking moves like this.
I agree 1,000% with that. Absolutely. Absolutely. And
I didn't think this was going to John steaming about a beat at the Meadowlands 10 years ago. I think that's where the conversation is going.
That's it's not even real black type. So, yeah.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad it's memorable for some reason. If it's the
Gary, I remember that break. I used to go to the Meadowlands all the time. I used to do the double. I used to daily double and go to Belmont during the afternoon and then go out to Meadowlands at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a degenerate. That's why.
That was more disposable income, apparently.
I think Woodbine does one of those as a race for all grays. We should find a really dark gray and get some revenge and send that horse up to Woodbine, John.
Exactly. That'll be the takeaway. Yep.
Paint Blue Buff's tail brown.
Right.
Send him up there.
Right. But whatever it takes. Bill, I mean, you're connected with a lot of the people in Kentucky and stuff. Are you getting any feedback on the 140 mare rule at all? Good or bad?
Well, the only feedback I think was silence from some people who you would think that would have a lot to say about this. And, you know, as I reported the story, and I got comments from people. One thing that didn't reflect in the story was there were at least three or four very prominent people from very prominent farms that declined to comment. And that's one of the reasons why I brought up the whole lawsuit thing. You know, maybe the lawyers have told them, just you stay out of this and let's figure out what we're going to do. It was also interesting on that same vein that I asked Jim Gagliano for comment above and beyond what they put in the press release. Jim Gagliano, of course, the CEO of the Jockey Club, and he too wouldn't comment. So that makes me believe that the lawyers have said, you know, I don't know if lawsuits are imminent or not, but if the lawyers have said that, you know, just be careful in what you say. But John, I also agree with you. I mean, you know, I would talk to one guy at 4:30. He would say, this is the worst idea I've ever heard of. Then I'd call another guy at another farm at 4:45 and he'd say, this is a great idea. So there really doesn't seem to be uniform consensus on this. I mean, obviously the people, well, I mean, we can go right to the crux of it. The two stallion farms that dominate when it comes to horses that have huge books over 140 or actually over 200 are just two, Coolmore and Spendthrift. So, you know, what are they thinking and what's their next step? You know, I don't really know. I also, again, trying to read between the lines. If you remember in the original trial balloon that was floated out in September, they were going to start this right away. There were going to be various, all sorts of tiers and phases, just like they're doing with coronavirus almost, but it was going to start right away. So I think that the fact that the Jockey Club said that we're only going to do it with 2020 beyond, you know, the Coolmore Spendthrift Stallions and the others are not going to be impacted by this. It leads me to believe that, you know, they were talking beforehand and, you know, that this was a good compromise that maybe kept, you know, people who were very upset about this a little bit at bay. So again, if you have the stallion right now who's breeding 250 mares and just like, Joe said he's 7-8 years old. Well, you got another 15, 16 years. You can breed as many mares as you want. So, you know, I think that was a little bit to ease the pain. And, but yeah, I mean, you know, rarely do you see something where people are just all over the spectrum on this so far as, you know, they think it's a good idea or a bad idea.
Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies that save you taxes. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So for this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, we are thrilled to be joined by the president and the owner of Oaklawn Park, Louis Sella. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for including me.
Of course. So we wanted to have you on because you guys did what people thought was the impossible a month or two ago, and you had a full race meet in the era of the coronavirus pandemic. My first question is about, were there any obstacles or challenges that you faced along the way in keeping the track open for racing? And if so, do you have any kind of tips or pointers for other tracks that are starting to open up?
We had 1,000 obstacles, and it was very daunting. But the bottom line is we did come together, and it starts at the top. It starts with Governor Hutchinson, who had us outline what we were going to do. Keep in mind, when this thing first started, right in the middle of our meet, no one knew what or how to react and do to this. So we went online like everyone else and scoured what is the best practices, what can we possibly do to make it the most safe environment, but also run. So the governor signed off, our racing commission signed off, our horsemen signed off. So much of this had to do with our horsemen. They had to buy in. They had to really take it from the proverbial reins and run with it because it's their employees, their staff. And if they did not do what we set out with our protocols, it simply would not have happened. So it was truly a team effort. And we're very excited that we were able to get through it.
Wanted to follow up on that. Do you have any kind of advice for other tracks that are starting to open up in these next couple weeks?
Well, we've communicated with all the tracks, starting with Tampa and Gulfstream and Santa Anita. We've talked to all of them. I've talked to Bill Carstangen and the folks over at Churchill. We've given all of them our playbook. We know that it works at Oaklawn. It worked at Oaklawn, and they may or may not want to implement everything that we've done. We did not know if some or everything is required. So we threw in the kitchen sink. We did everything. And I think from that, some of the tracks will learn that they can kind of pick and choose. Some of the things we did was probably extraordinary. But again, at the time, we were up against a big dark cloud, didn't know what was in front of us. So we threw in the proverbial kitchen sink.
Hey, Lewis, it's Bill Finley, and I think I speak for Joe and everybody at the TDN and perhaps everybody in racing, just saying a big thank you for what you guys did and how you got through the meet and what a pleasure it was for horse players to have something to bet on, a great signal, and have something to talk about, debate the Arkansas Derby, et cetera. So kudos to you and the whole team. Now, my question is, we exchanged emails a couple weeks ago, and I asked you if there's any chance that Oaklawn would extend the meet beyond last Saturday. You said no, and the reasons you gave were twofold, one of which was a little bit surprising. You said we really don't have any purse money left. And people may wonder, well, wait a minute, Oaklawn was handling record amount on Arkansas Derby Day. How could they have run out of purse money? I imagine the answer may have something to do with how little money the tracks gets from ADWs, but I'll let you answer that question.
Yeah, it's we have a formula, as do all the tracks. And a vast majority of all our money was generated last year through our ADW in the summer. And so much of it is during this year, during our casino operations. We cannot have the purses that we have at $600,000 a day if we did not have that casino alternative revenue source. And so we generated all of this money. The spigot turned off on March 15th. And so we had to go back and say, okay, how much money was generated last year? All of the money that was generated this year during our simulcast signal out, we'll get the benefit of that next year, but not this year. And so we reduced our purses by 35% in anticipation of trying to make the numbers work. Our horsemen agreed, our commission agreed. And that's why we were able to give away not quite 30, just a freckle under $30 million, which is extraordinary given the circumstances.
Hey, Lewis, it's Alan Carrasso, and thanks for being with us. Can you just talk in a broader sense, not necessarily coronavirus related, but the strides that Oaklawn has made over the past, say, 5 or 10 years to join on a purse money level, the likes of Santa Anita, purse level, the likes of Saratoga. Can you just talk about Oaklawn basically becoming and joining the big leagues?
Well, thank you. And we like to be considered in that as a big in the big leagues. It starts with good racing. It starts with ownership management that's committed to horse racing. We put every penny we can back into horse racing. It comes with our Horsemen's Association, the local HBPA. They understand what it takes to put on a big show, and it takes the state to understand we have to keep taxes low. We can't do restrictive. And if we're able to work with those three groups, we'll be able to put on a good show. And that's what we did starting. It really started with Smarty Jones in 2005 And it went through this past season. We were fortunate enough that if there is a question of overpayment, we'll do it. If there's a question of being fair when we have generated excess funds because of some entity, for instance, the revenue source of our casino operations, we're going to put it into racing today. And we're also going to put money back into the facilities. That is a big, big part of it. Many, many tracks, even if they have casinos, they don't put the money and investment back into racing. Last year, we built 6 new barns. This year, we're planning on building 3 new barns. We pick up the surface, the track surface. A lot of people don't know this, and we've talked to many other tracks about it. It's a very expensive endeavor, but we pick up the track cushion, the top 4 to 6 inches of our track, every single summer. And we pick it up, and we put it on the side, and that lets us remix it and put it to the formula of clay, silt, and sand that we are used to and we like. But it also lets us inspect the base, the track base. And by doing that, we knock on wood, we have a very safe and good track consistently year over year. And because of that, we get the best horses. They know it's a safe environment. They know it's a safe track. They know management's going to put racing first. And so when you get the quality, when you get the purses, it all tends to meld. And that's why we have great attendance. We have the best fans in the world. They love the sport of horse racing, and they're going to show up to see it.
I'm glad you brought up the track surface, because one of the things that I've always thought about Oak Lawn is, you know, it's steadily grown in prominence and importance and field quality and horse quality. The one thing I always felt like it was missing was a turf course. And I think that was the one thing that could make you compete with the other tracks even more. Is there a reason that I haven't heard for why you guys don't have a turf course? Is it weather related? Is it climate? Is it logistics? Why do you guys not have a turf course?
We have a perfect season for Oakland. It's a spring season. It ends up until a year ago, 3 weeks before the Kentucky Derby, now on May 2. The climate doesn't even really warm up, and it's amenable to growing grass to make it a manicured turf that we would want and require. The bottom line is you'd probably be able to get it for the month of April. That's it. So we don't want to expand. We love what we have in Arkansas. We don't want to have a fall meet. And it's about not trying to compete against some of those great tracks like Keeneland, we have in New Jersey at Monmouth, Churchill, of course, Saratoga in the fall. We don't want to compete against that, and we can't. We don't want to pretend that we could. So we really focus on our meet, our spring season, dirt racing, the best 3-year-old racing. And I might add, we're growing into the best 4-year-old and older horse racing as well, evidenced by our Oakland handicap this year.
Lewis, the last I looked, the Oakland was not named among the tracks that were part of the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition. Now, maybe that was an omission from their part, but I just want to see where Oakland stands so far as being a member of the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition, and whether you're in or out, what about adhering to some of the things they've been asking for, in particular, no Lasix in any stakes races in 2021? I think the 2-year-old thing would not apply to you with no Lasix in 2-year-olds, since you essentially don't have any 2-year-old races.
Right, we don't. When this all bubbled up last fall, we were part of it. And then a couple of the tracks decided to go in a different direction and left us out. The NTRA has put forth their programs. The bottom line is this: we do more at Oaklawn than the NTRA has suggested with their safety alliance. Other than the Lasix issue, we do more at Oaklawn than the track safety alliance. We're focusing actually, and we're going to make some news this summer. We've worked, and this is unheard of. And you see this with announcements in some of the other jurisdictions where the horsemen don't want this, management does want this, and they have a conflict. Well, during this past season, we have met with our horsemen several of them and through the association and the board. And we have come up with about 15 items that far exceeds anything that's currently proposed in racing. And what's remarkable is that it's Oaklawn and it's the Arkansas HBPA that's going to promote this. And so what we're going to show off this summer is something that far exceeds what we're hearing in other jurisdictions. But the only reason we're able to do this is because we're working with our horsemen. And we're tied together on this. So we're excited to announce some things later this summer and certainly before the next season that we're going to implement.
Louis, can I just ask you what lessons you learned in terms of racetrack management and business acumen from your father?
Well, everything in racing I've learned from him. I started at a young age at the track, and I only had one mentor, and that was him. And I was fortunate enough to be in the room where it happened, where he made phone calls, for instance, with Mr. Dutchess-Wass when we started interstate commingled simulcasting. That had never been done before. It was 1989, and we took all of Arlington's car. Well, today it represents over 90% of the North American handle. When dad put forth the Smarty Jones, Rachel Alexandra meet that did not happen, the match race, it did not happen, but it was pretty neat that we did. And the Smarty Jones, of course, for our 100th anniversary. The bottom line, and I think the biggest takeaway, is what he taught me is racing's first, and you have to believe it. Racing is first, and if you have an ability to put on a show that might have a fun little twist, we have an ability to do that. Kind of like splitting the Rebel last year, kind of like splitting the Derby this year. Makes zero economic sense. But if it's good for the racing, it'll work out for the best at the end. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway, is that we have an ability at Oaklawn to do that. We recognize other jurisdictions do not. But we like to take advantage of that. And that's why we see some of the things that we see at Oaklawn.
Just one more question, because we won't see you guys again until next year. You guys have been expanding, obviously, in terms of the stakes program, in terms of purse money, in terms of the hotel and the casino. You mentioned some safety reforms that are coming that you're going to announce later this summer. What else can we look forward to at Oaklawn in 2021?
Well, starting with the 200-room hotel, that's back on schedule. And what's neat about that, there's really no other racetrack out there that has at our level. I realize I think the Saratoga Casino might have one on the track. But at our level with Thoroughbred Racing, we're going to have a 200-room hotel that's on the first turn. We're going to have new food and beverage that's right on the first turn. It's going to be racing themed, which is going to be pretty neat. So again, what we're doing, and you'll see it next year, is really good racing, but now to a whole different level that's not seen before. I know Churchill's building their hotel, and they're going to follow suit after us, but that's going to be pretty neat when you have all these rooms facing the track. And you can see morning training or afternoon racing from your room. That's unheard of, especially at this level. And we're very excited about that.
All right. I think that's all we got for you, Louis. I just want to echo what Bill said before. I know you guys had to walk a real tightrope with this meet, and us and all of the horse players and racing fans really appreciate you guys being able to pull it off and presenting such great racing. So thanks for that. And then thanks for being on with us as well.
You bet. Thank you. And just to let oh, some of the details that we've shared with other tracks, we take the temperature of every single person every single day. That's over 900 people from March 15 on. And we have color-coded bands. So today is yellow, tomorrow might be green. If you're not wearing the right color, you're step aside immediately. We have our trainers going into their barns temping also every single day. So it's been truly a group effort, and we're very fortunate that we were able to pull this off. And I hope the other tracks will as well.
I agree. Other tracks out there, listen to Louis. Thanks so much for the time, Louis. Appreciate it. Stay safe.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Louis.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Lewis Sello will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So before we sign off for the day, my dog's whining at me right now to eat. We're going to talk a little bit about a series that we've been running in the TDN in the past week or so about how to make betting more friendly. And it's something we talk about a lot on this show, about how to improve the betting product, about how to improve the presentation of the betting product. Brian had a good piece on Sunday, I believe, about some of the things that could be done. So I'll toss it to him in a second. But one of the points that he made was about handicapping contests. And I don't want to steal his thunder, but that was kind of one of the things I felt that racing has not marketed well, because that's one of the few sectors of horse betting that is growing and that is growing in interest. And I think also it's a good intro if you have someone at the track who doesn't want to learn pick fives and pick fours and superfectas and all that. You can put them in one of these contests where all you have to do is pick one horse, win place, and then see where your total is at the end. It's a lot more akin to the World Series of Poker or something like that. So, Ryan, what else did you think?
Well, but on the tournament thing, it's funny. We held a free tournament on Arkansas Derby Day, basically just trying to get people interested in our partnership. And the prizes were, you know, like credits to buy into horses. So basically you were winning the opportunity to, you were winning $250 and then had to spend another more money than that to get in. But people loved it. People went wild. And it was a lot of people who I don't think had played in tournaments before, who probably don't even know that horse tourneys exist or anything. But, and they're, you know, more casual people, but these are people who own pieces of our horses and stuff for the most part. And they absolutely loved it. And I think they had a lot of fun. And I think for them, it was a lot more fun than, you know, maybe making a normal bet. And I mean, you couldn't play. Oaklawn is one of the tracks that doesn't allow sites like horse tourneys to use their races. So you couldn't have played in a contest that day on the major site. And I'm certain that people who handicapped those races for our little free contest probably bet more into the pool that day than they would normally. And I think that's the big thing. It's a handle driver. Tracks act like it's competition. I think it's the complete opposite. And I don't understand why every track doesn't have their own tournament on their website. I mean, there might be some like legal thing that I'm not aware of, but it seems super obvious to me.
Well, this is something that I think tracks have been better about getting into. I think Naira does a good job every summer at Saratoga. They have the Saratoga Handicapping Challenge. They also have the Low Roller Challenge, which they do it. You can just buy in for $40, and it's a good way to get some action. Don't tell our Green Group Guest of the Week, Lewis Sella, that you were operating an illegal tournament.
I don't think it was illegal. I'm confident it wasn't illegal. We run horses there.
But yeah, I think it is something that tracks are starting to slowly realize as a driver of handle and a driver of new participants. But that's one for sure. I think also, you know, Brian had an interesting thought about how, you know, maybe we should dumb down the past performances because people that get into racing and handicapping do it because they love the challenge. They love the puzzle of it. I agree with that. But I do think that, you know, Pat Cummins has banged this drum before about more free data and more easily accessible data. Even like just watching TVG, like granted, if you're watching TVG, you're probably already a pretty hardcore horse player, but just, they never seem to go through the past performances. It's kind of just all talk and analysis from talking heads, which ironically were just a bunch of talking heads. So I guess that's a little hypocritical, but I would love to see kind of just a run through, or even on like Talking Horses in the Naira broadcast, like just something to run people through the past performances and give them just some brief pointers and stuff to look out for. I think just lowering the barrier to entry in that way, where you feel like you at least somehow appreciate and understand the basics of reading the past performances, I think that could go a long way.
And I think the thing about my piece that probably I think got the most feedback was about published workouts. And I think I'm going to write something else on that. I'd be curious to hear John's opinion on this.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that.
There is really nothing more absurd than the way we publish workouts. Clockers have really no oversight. I mean, frankly, they're altering stuff. They're betting races based on these altered workouts. And it's completely unregulated. And it sits there as Pat Cummings put it in a good way. It sits there as, you know, the workout might say, it'll say 4 furlongs, 48 flat, whatever it is. And it's next to all this factual information. And it's not factual in any way. And it's, people are obviously betting races based on what they're looking at. And I mean, I think there needs to be a complete overhaul of that. It's not the biggest issue in racing by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's kind of a microcosm of how we do things and how, you know, we all kind of accept it as fact. If you're talking to a person who's a serious bettor and you quote a workout time, they're going to tell you you're an idiot and, you know, who looks at workout times. But how did we get to a point where that's acceptable for a gambling game?
Yeah, and Brian, I remember very early on in our racing career in the 80s, pulling into Monmouth Park, and right behind us was a new, I think it was, you know, call it was 1987. So it was a 1988, you know, Corvette convertible. And the guy pulled in and threw the keys to Salty and then ran in. And I said to Salty, oh, is that an owner? No. Is that that must be a jockey agent? No, that's the clocker. And basically the clockers can, you know, like you said, they have no oversight. They have nobody, no responsibility to anybody but themselves. And they're the biggest gamblers, you know, on the racetrack. And they know every 2-year-old that goes into a race, and they know which of those, you know, works were legitimate or not. And it's kind of like a joke. It's kind of a dirty little secret in the, on the racetrack as far as, you know, was this a real work or, you know, was it not? And in this day and age where you get to watch the breezes now online, that has to be cleaned up as well, because people can hand time it now and know whether or not, you know, it's really, you know, factual information. But I thought out of everything you said in your article, I thought that I'm glad you made that the number one point out of the four that you mentioned, because to me, that's just something that we need to clean up and avoid this exploitation of data again.
Right. Well, I mean, we had a horse a couple of years ago who won second out, was training great. I mean, she there was one work she breezed in like 34 flat. You know, the workout was published as 38 or something, and we were hand timing it ourselves to figure out, you know, were we missing something, were we wrong? And I mean, she went off at a way shorter price than she should have on paper, and I mean, I bet a lot, but I didn't bet enough to make her 5-1 or whatever she was. So I, you know, like you said, it's kind of a dirty little secret that I think really needs to be addressed.
And now with the importance of having breezes for horses that are coming off the vets list or horses that haven't run in a certain period of time, and there's a mandated breeze, you know, it's even more imperative to have that information be truthful rather than just, you know, oh, the horse was training at an offsite training facility. And yeah, I breezed them, you know, 3 furlongs in 38 on this date. Okay, they take it as gospel. But in reality, if the rule is there to try to protect the horse and the people who own the horse and the betting public, then you got to follow through and make it part of that, you know, part of that cleanup as well.
I think the remedies to that potentially, like Brian mentioned, the XBTV TV videos of workouts are great, because then you can make your own analysis and your own determination, your handicapping. Honestly, I've missed that recently because I'm guessing they don't have people shooting workouts anymore at Palm Meadows and Pace and Palm Beach Downs with good reason. But that's something that you can see with your own two eyes and you can make your own determination. The other thing is, I think that every major track should have published clocker reports on their website. Now, that's not necessarily foolproof, because you could have shady clockers working for tracks as well, but at least then there's some accountability where people can see on the official website, you know, what horse worked with who, what the time was, some kind of short comment. Like, I understand that's a big undertaking, but Woodbine does an example of that. Keeneland does kind of a bare bones example of that. So there are some tracks that are doing it. And I think that's more accountability than the mysterious clocker that's publishing the workouts to Equibase. And I think, you know, obviously they're a competitor, but I think Mike Welsh and Donald Harris and Payson Dave do a really good job over at the DRF Clocker Report. And I think that's some of the way that's reading stuff like that is a way to navigate through the BS of the published clocker times, but that costs money. Like that's like $15 a card, and not everybody can afford that on top of past performances and all the other unnecessary costs that it takes to just to bet on a damn horse race. So I think it's something that tracks should look toward to just give more transparency. We talk about it, transparency. John, the example you brought up, we talked about it before about horses coming back off the layoffs, coming back and dropping in class and claiming price. And you have no idea what has happened with this horse. And I think, you know, vet reports are a good way to start, but at the very least, clocker reports. So you can see what the horse is doing on the track. And I think that's, you know, that's a good way. That's a good small step to go a long way in earning the trust of the bettors and the bettors of your customers.
I heard that some tracks were going to do that, but they had to limit it to 140 horses.
Oh boy. Go on this long right. Speed. You have to undercut it with your stupid joke.
It was not his worst joke by any stretch of the imagination.
It was pretty
John. For John, that was a good one.
All right.
I'm here for you, Bill. Anytime you want to jump in and save me, you want to throw me a lifeline?
No, I got nothing to say.
Next time you're pounding the table for 5 minutes, John, I'll slip in a stupid joke at the end. Don't worry.
I look forward to it. You can still do it. You can still, you know, go ahead and cut that one in.
You already put me to sleep with your breeding talk.
Aaron. I'm sorry.
So that's going to do it for this week's episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, all wagers through Keeneland Select this month will go to their Nourish the Backstretch initiative. So support Keeneland Select, support the backstretch workers in the Lexington community. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, our Green Group guest of the week, Louis Stella, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Nathan Wilkinson and Anthony LaRocca, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Stay safe out there. We will see you next week.